Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of ID the Future. This is Logan Gage for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. And joining us today, we have a very special guest in John Mark Reynolds, the author of a new book, and it's entitled When Athens Meets Jerusalem. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Reynolds.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here.
For those of you who don't know already, Dr. Reynolds holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Rochester, and he is the founder and the director of the Torrey Honors Institute at Biola University, which, if I'm correct, is the Great Books Program. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a community-based Great Books Program that has educated hundreds of students from a classical and Christian perspective, sent them all over the world, doing things from singing opera for the Queen of England to doing PhDs in philosophy and JDs in law and working in business and in the Marine Corps.
Great, great. And I should probably also mention that Dr. Reynolds is a fellow of Discovery Institute, and the new book is actually right along those lines of the Torrey Honors Institute. It's an introduction to classical and Christian thought. And I just wanted to ask, first of all, what were your goals in writing this book, and who is it aimed at?
Well, there are three major goals. First of all, too many people don't realize the wonderful heritage that Christians and even secular people in Western civilization have in a magnificent fusion that occurred between Jewish, Christian, and Greek and Roman thought in the first, second, and third centuries. That was an important part of producing the civilization that benefits us so much today. Secondly, Christendom, the product of that fusion, has been under attack lately, both by secular people who don't like the religious implications of it, and by some Christian people who look at the mistakes that Christians have made in this fusion and want to somehow start over. And third, my own personal journey, both of faith and intellectually, has benefited from this fusion. So in some ways, this book is a kind of testimony. As far as intelligent design goes, sometimes the origins of philosophy, particularly the origins of philosophy as it relates to science, have been told in a secular way, as if what happened was a gradual rise in naturalism that got rid of religion, when instead what you see is a rise of intelligent design thinking amongst pre-Socratic and Platonic philosophers.
Very good, very good. One question I had after reading your introduction was did you find any surprising instances of Greek and or Roman concepts in early Christian writings, and, or vice versa, Christian influence in more secular philosophy or other writings or parts of culture at the time that you hadn't previously noticed in terms of influence of one upon the other?
Well, of course, when I was in grad school, I started thinking about this and just saw lots of instances of cross-pollinization. So, for example, when Christians today sing, "This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature rings, and round me rings the music of the spheres," they've been influenced deeply by Pythagorean philosophy, a kind of pre-Socratic philosophical school from which we can learn a great deal in thinking about the cosmos. On the other hand, people that were hostile to Christianity were so taken by some Christian solutions in the area of the Trinity that if you look at post-Christian Platonic philosophy, it often works in trinities of its own, pretty obviously deeply influenced by the Christian solution to the problem of the one and the many and how those two concepts relate.
Now, what important things can someone, say just a modern person today, whether secular or Christian, what can they understand? What can they not understand today, rather, without understanding at least somewhat classical or Christian thought?
Well, if you don't know where you've come from, it's pretty hard to get a good idea of where you're going or the best ways to go. And a lot of the options that are right now before us in the area of religion and science, or just thinking about science, period, have been tried out in the ancient world. I mean, there were hundreds of years when purely secular thought could have produced science if they wanted to. They were harmed by paganism, of course, certain forms of paganism, but also secular thought without Judaism, without Christianity, proved inadequate to form modern science. And it really took a fusion of Christian thought, secular thought, Islamic thought, help from Jewish scholars to put together the scientific world we know. So there's never really been a time in the history of ideas, certainly in the area I'm dealing with, where there's been a clear demarcation between religion and science of the sort that some people today would want to make. That just didn't ever happen. And the great contributors to the development of science, from Plato to Aristotle, the two main figures I deal with in this book, I wouldn't have even understood the distinction of those categories.
What did Eastern Christendom or the Eastern Church contribute to sort of this great conversation that you're discussing in your book? What's their contribution to this overall conversation?
Well, that's a very important question, because following a kind of ethnocentrism that occurred with Edward Gibbon in the 18th century, some people thought of Byzantium as a kind of long declining failure, an ugly, disorderly place, monk-ridden and priest-ridden, and of no value to culture. And now, of course, this view has been utterly revised in a flourishing field called Byzantine studies. But probably for the general listener, it's important to know that the Renaissance was deeply influenced by Christian thinkers who came over even before the fall of Constantinople to the Turks and began to educate Florentines and other people. I'm about to go visit Florence, as a matter of fact, and we'll see some of the fruit of that Platonic and Christian thought that came from Byzantium. Byzantium has an interesting long thousand-year history of interaction with the best secular thought. There was always a secular university running. That doesn't mean non-Christian. It was, of course, run by Christians, but non-theological, with theological thinking in Eastern Christendom. And by the time Constantinople fell, that had been a major force in creating the Renaissance. Sometimes we almost give too much credit to the Muslims of Spain and other areas for bringing in some classical ideas into the West, when in fact the Byzantines were equally responsible. Now, of course, Spanish Islamic thinkers, first rate, other Islamic thinkers' contribution to science, huge. I don't want to downplay that. But in the history of ideas, starting in the 18th century, for some reason it became fashionable to denigrate the contribution of the Eastern Christians.
So what role does classical and Christian thought play? What role did it play in the development of modern science as we know it? What are they building on from the thinkers that you are sort of tackling in this book?
Well, of course, Pope Benedict has written about this a great deal, so this isn't an idea eccentric to me. And what I'm doing is basically giving a very introductory set of ideas. But the Greeks were responsible for creating a vocabulary, discovering logic, at least basic logic, putting together a system, a way of thinking. And then I think Christians brought to the table the fact that though the universe was good and orderly and could be studied, it wasn't God, so it was appropriate to study it. That kind of balance that you find both in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity gave motivation for scientists to think God's thoughts after him. And you see a much greater motivation for scientific study in Christians than you found in the Greek gentlemen, who often Aristotle had to urge that dissecting a worm wasn't beneath a gentleman. Christians, because of the incarnation, had a much better motivation for studying the material world. It was helpful to them.
So we often hear that thinking about design in nature is a 20th century fundamentalist phenomenon, or at best maybe an invention of William Paley in the 19th century. Give us a sense of the development of design thinking in the ancient world. Were these concepts widely discussed?
Well, of course, they were discussed by the pre-Socratics, who made arguments, not to the extent we can tell. We only have fragments of the pre-Socratics, design-like arguments. But Plato has a full-blown design argument in the 10th book of his Laws, where he argues against atheism because of the design he sees in the universe. And so what we can see is that it didn't take Christian fundamentalism to recognize design or see its importance. Plato thought that belief in design was important both to undergird philosophy and undergird society, rational and ethical thinking. And so this isn't an idea that some televangelist made up for fun and profit, but it's a very ancient idea. Now, of course, it was opposed by secularists, much later secularists like Lucretius, who didn't like this kind of idea. But those were dead ends. It really, the Platonic thinkers and the Aristotelian thinkers, one thinks of Copernicus, for example, or Kepler, were the most fecund, the most fruitful. So it wasn't particularly secularist denying design or denying mathematical patterns that they saw as ideas in the mind of God. But Neoplatonists and Thomists, more Aristotelian thinkers like Kepler, like Copernicus, like Galileo, that made the great progress that produced the scientific revolution.
And is their concept of design in nature very far removed from our own or not?
Well, you have two different concepts of design in Plato and Aristotle, and we probably don't need to get into the long, interesting debates between even Christians about which one is preparable. I am a Neoplatonist, so I'm not trying to hide my views, but surely there were very sophisticated, for the period, concepts of design in nature, either as imitation of great Platonic forms, either in the mind of God or just existing themselves, or immanent in nature, rising out of informed matter, a combination of matter, but, you know, holomorphism. You have to excuse me, I'm sitting in a dentist chair, a bit numb in the mouth, so if my pronunciations are bad,
you'll be excused.
That's part of the reason why, anyway. And so those are very different concepts of design and where design comes from, but they were both important.
So lastly, where do you see Greek and Roman ideas at work today in our culture in terms of maybe high culture or art or literature or even just pop culture? Where do you see these ideas influencing our society today?
Well, of course, anytime you go to a movie or go online and see someone talking about a soulmate, there's an idea that Plato first widely promoted, though he didn't like it, in his dialogue, The Symposium. And so literature and art and culture owes almost everything either to Greek and Roman thought or to a fusion of Jewish and Islamic and Christian and Greek and Roman thought that produced Western civilization. So if you live in the West, it's hard to turn on your television and see anything that doesn't reflect that fusion. It may be many steps removed. It may be dumbed down. But safe to say that when Pocahontas in the old Disney film, old to my children anyway, sang, "You can never step in the same river twice," she was directly repeating the words of Heraclitus, a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher living in the city of Ephesus. So that was exciting to me when I first saw that film.
Very good. Very good. Well, the new book is called When Athens Met Jerusalem. This is an introduction to classical and Christian thought, and we are so thankful to John Mark Reynolds for joining us today. Best of luck with the book and also with the dentist chair.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone is thrilled to think of going to the dentist themselves, but it's been a pleasure to be with you.
All right. Well, this is Logan Gage for ID the Future.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.